On Friday, we had a little outing. Peter driving our Yud, taking us to Glasshouse Mountains. They're really quite spectacular. It's, I think, originally volcanic. Some 20 million years ago or something, some volcanic eruption, and only in the internal part of that volcano is still there. So I've got these quite steep hills jutting out of the landscape. Nowadays, when you hear Glasshouse, and you're thinking on something where they're growing tomatoes or something, but it's actually Glasshouse in the early 19th century usage, the industry, the kind of factories which were producing glass, and they apparently looked like that. So nowadays, no one would know what this is meant to be. You think of a glass house, a house built of glass to produce plants in. These were really special, and they have very strong spiritual and cultural meaning for the Aboriginal community. We didn't climb the highest, because it involves rock scrambling, as they call it. It's not exactly rock climbing, what they call rock scrambling. So we climbed Mount Ngungun, which is quite manageable. Quite a few steps, quite steep, but easily manageable even for elderly monks like myself. And you have these gorgeous views on top. You can see the highest and the steepest. Mount Biaba is the highest. Mount Kunauren, I think, is the steepest. They closed that already in the 1990s because people would unfortunately have accidents and even quite a few fatalities of people trying to climb that. So that one is completely closed with a fine. But you can see these two. It looks great in the background. And right on the highest point, is on top, is just a rocky outcrop. And this rugged peak, right on top, and I sat down, going into a meditation photo. But I felt it's one of these kind of fake meditation photos, which you sometimes see when monks sit in these spectacular locations meditating. I think you have all seen photos like that. Because usually this is not, it looks spectacular in a photo, but if you really want to cultivate bhavana, you wouldn't actually sit in that location. It's far too exposed or too hot or too difficult or too windy or whatever, and it's not really suitable. So I was sitting down with the intention of getting just one of these kind of fake photos to look spectacular. But once I sat there, I thought, oh, wow, this is really nice. Had a really good energy. So after the photo, I got my hat on again. It doesn't look nice. You obviously need a hat in the full sun there, but it doesn't look nice on the photo. So I got the hat back on, and then I used my rope to bolster a few of these sharp edges from this rocky outcrop. But then I was sitting there maybe half an hour, and it was really, really good, and I was amazed. It felt like as if I could feel this rock somehow, as if my body becomes part of this rock. It felt incredibly stable. Now, usually it's a very exposed position. There's a sheer drop, a couple of dozen meters, I think, almost right next to you. And also quite a bit of wind up there, and so usually you would feel rather exposed or a bit shaky, but didn't feel like that at all. And I felt rock stable, and like I can connect and feel the energy of this rock under me. I really loved it. A very strong perception of the physical elements. Chaturmahabhutika, the four great physical elements. Now, this is how the Buddha described matter. in a form, rupa, as we can subjectively experience it. Sometimes people may be wondering, why did the Buddha didn't use the periodic table of the chemical elements, or in physics, you've got protons, electrons, neutrons, or subatomic particles, and so on. But this is not something which you can directly experience as matter. But with our bodies, we can experience external or even internal material form within these four qualities. The one is stability, weight, inertia, and of course a big rock, volcanic rock like this mountain Gangan, has that element very, very prominent. And I could really relate to that, because of course our body is also a lot of earth element, it's also a lot of water. But the rigidity, stability, that comes from the earth element, like a skeleton. And when you're sitting there in a cross-legged, it's quite a stable posture, and then you're connecting. So I could really feel like my internal earth element, a kind of connecting or merging, or however you subjectively want to describe that, with this big, big rock. And then also the heat element, and very prominent, it was just early afternoon. I saw the sun, fortunately not too bad in mid-April, but still quite strong. But because the wind element was also quite strong, it was bearable, even pleasant for half an hour maybe. And I could feel it all, and I could feel this stability of the rock. I could obviously feel the sun onto my head, onto my whole body. Only a few white clouds in the sky, the full sun. But then cool down from the breeze, from the ocean, a very prominent wind element. The only one which was not prominent is a water element, but I was very happy about that. It's not my element anyhow. I like really fire, earth, and to some extent wind, mostly fire and earth. That's also that is ones I really like, I can relate best to some extent wind, not so much water, particularly not cold water. Cold water is not my element at all. So it was really enjoyable. And it reminded me how beneficial it can be to occasionally go out and sit in nature, experiment, try out different locations. If you read the suttas, it was so common, the Buddha himself, the great monks, they would travel, they would be on charika, and the same is still in the tradition of Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Shastri did it in his younger years, and Venerable Jnanavimala did it for 25 years in Sri Lanka. Traveling around, moving around, and then of course you have to sit down in whatever is a suitable spot, what you can find. It will often be under a tree, and maybe in a little cave or an overhang. It can be in a ravine, at a cliff, somewhere in the forest, of course, in an empty hut, an empty dwelling is also recommended. But there are different energies, and sometimes it can really give a new input to your meditation, connecting with the different energies, good energies in particular, in special places in nature. I cannot explain what kind of energies you connect there. I think there are kind of alternative sciences concerned with this. I think they talk about these ley lines, supposedly energy, and they say some of these ancient monuments are on these energy lines. Can't comment on that, I haven't studied that. But they also say that all the Buddhas in this eon will attain Sammasambuddhi in exactly the same spot. Which first of all throws up the question, what is the same spot if you're talking about geologically significant time frames? The previous Buddhas, it must be millions of years ago. So anything which you would normally use to describe the same location would have changed. You cannot say it's close to that river or close to that hill or close to that mountain. You cannot say this is the elevation and the distance to the shoreline, because all of that is changing. So it's quite fascinating to even try to contemplate what exactly is the definition there. But we read that the Buddha would smile in a certain location, and then he would talk about a past life of his and some significant, spiritually significant event happening in that location. But sometimes, really, really long, long time ago, which must be in our reckoning, multi-millions of years. So what is the same spot there? I can't really explain to you how it works. But I'm totally convinced, and one can connect with it, and one can feel that there are certain energies in certain places. And I think it's helpful to occasionally at least utilize it for our meditation. In my own case, I tend to be more experimental when it comes to walking. For sitting, usually I try to have it really nice for my posture and then the support for the knee and so on. But I find it easier with walking. I don't really mind if it's a little bit uneven and so on. I can still enjoy walking meditation quite quickly. And of course, it doesn't have to be a sitting posture. We have to be careful of this, more of the same, meditating and getting into this trap of routine, continuing the same thing. If with the same thing we haven't liberated our heart yet, then the same thing is probably not going to do it. There has to be something new. But we are all creatures of habit, and it happens very quickly that we just run through the same program. And one way of getting out of that and breaking the routine and getting the beginner's mind, what they call beginner's mind in Zen, what you might call also a childlike mind. Today we had a little girl coming for her third birthday. The parents bringing her. And that was quite funny. They act different than adults, and they do things which you wouldn't expect. Suddenly running here or doing this kind of, doing little dance or whatever. Which no adult would ever do, because it's not what you do in a monastery. Not that I want to encourage people to start dancing or running from here to there in the shrine room, but it can be very refreshing, interacting with young kids and this spontaneity and this freshness and newness and this suddenly doing something unexpected. And the great Zen masters were famous for that. But many people would say that also about Ajahn Chah, that he was quite unpredictable, and he would often suddenly come up with something which no one had expected at all, completely new. Of course, that is the only way to attain freedom and liberation. The old stuff you have been doing for I don't know how many eons, endless eons in samsara, that's obviously not getting you there. It has to be some absolutely, totally new, fresh approach of looking at things. And a changing posture can support that, and in particular going out and connecting with different locations in nature. Also the change of scenery, being in a different environment, very helpful. Lumpur Khao, one of the very senior disciples of Ajahn Mun, he was particularly known for that. he would always find when he stays in one place and settles in, that his meditation after some time would kind of decline because he gets into this routine, the routine, and it's just the same. And he would love, you know, to go on Charvaka and be in dangerous places. And that is one reason that Ajahn Mun sent them to dangerous places. And if there are snakes, anywhere you may step, and centipedes may crawl over you and bite you at night when you sleep, and all kinds of insects may bite you, and tigers are growling in the distance, and so on. You have a very, very sharp mind. Sometimes I talked about the difference between the domesticated pig and the wild boar. It's basically the same kind of animal. After a long period of domestication, you've got the domesticated pig lying there, fattened, and having an easy time. If you compare that with a wild boar, all the senses are really sharp because he's out there, constantly exposed to danger. And a tiger may jump at him, a snake may bite, hunters may get him. But it means he's really sharp, intelligent, sharp faculties. Walking on grass, walking on sand at the beach, or even just walking on dirt, or even walking on rock. You wouldn't want to do a very long walking on the Bok River on Friday, it's too uneven. That can be a good foot massage if you walk a little bit on these uneven rocks, carefully, slowly. It's like foot massage. Our body isn't actually designed for wearing these shoes. It's not the original design. That is quite recent in our evolution that we're wearing shoes. Foot is designed for natural contact with natural ground and soil and so on. It's a big problem for elephants in captivity. Because then they often stand on this concrete surface, and they also don't walk so much, but their design and their feet are designed to walk on natural ground and to walk tremendous distances. They're constantly moving around. That's similar for us. So another encouragement, try to do walking meditation on grass, on sand, even on rock, on the beach. A beach is another place. And Australia is fantastic because you can actually find a beach where you can go as a monk here. In Germany, it would be very hard, because among all the bikini girls and so on, a bit out of place. But in Australia, you can find the kind of abandoned beaches. A few years ago, with an old friend, we went up to the town of 70 or something. Town of 70-75 or 70-79. Anyway, have you been there, Johanna?
No, but I heard Nikki went there.
Nikki's been in. We went there, and then we went to one beach in a national park, and 1 or 2 hours we spent there, and we were the only people on the beach, the only humans you could see anywhere. Fantastic for monks. There's another place where you have the elements extremely strong. They also have got the water element. You may not have the earth element so prominent, but you have the sand, you have the wind, you have the sun, you have the water. And when you walk there, and you can experience that. Once you feel the external elements and experience them, then you can maybe also perceive and contemplate the same elements internally, more successfully. It's not so much thinking about them when you do element contemplation. You can do that as well, but it's just directly experience them, because this is why the Buddha chose these four qualities of matter, because it's the four attributes of matter that you can experience with your body.
And they are constantly exchanging each other. It's very apparent with the wind element, the breath going in and out. But it's the same with the water element, drinking water, sweating, urinating, tears, saliva, and so on. There's constantly going in and out. Heat element is also very obvious. Now the sun, once you're exposed to the sun, you heat up and then your body is hot internally. So you can directly experience that, how these elements interact and what they feel like, how you experience them and how they are changing. But to see how they are anicca, that they are impermanent, unreliable, changeable, that they are not safe, that they are insubstantial, that they are ultimately disappointing and so on. First of all, you have to experience them. We can't really gain insight into the impermanence of something which we haven't experienced. That doesn't really work. So you have to feel the elements in order then to contemplate and perceive and see and observe their impermanence and their not me, not mine, not safe nature, and their ultimately disappointing nature. Tree huggers. We went to a place where they literally have a tree hugger group, but they wouldn't let us in there. This is a folk festival. What was it? Woodford Folk Festival. But outside festival time, you can't go in there. I was a little bit disappointed. I'd seen that they have big prayer wheels and things on their grounds. And on their website, they have a tree hugger group. It's a little bit, I think, a derogative term for used for against the greenies, so to speak. And have you ever hugged a tree? If not, give it a try, because it has a strong energy. Because a tree, like Chinese, yin and yang, and heaven and earth, and so on, the tree connects it all. The tree is rooted in the earth element, and then the leaves going into the sky, so they have a connection between earth and heaven, and you have got the water coming out of the ground, evaporating, so there's something quite energetic, powerful happening. The photosynthesis producing oxygen. But again, talking about subjectively, directly feeling it. And there's obviously no coincidence that all Buddhas attain Sammasambodhi sitting on a tree. It is different trees. Each Buddha has a different tree of enlightenment. The Bodhi tree is for our Buddha. Others have different trees. But as every single Buddha is always on the tree. And that is the default accommodation, or however you want to call it, for Buddhist monks. That's what the preceptor is, one of the duties of the preceptor at ordination. He has to tell the monk who has just been ordained, the life gone forth has got the foot of a tree as a dwelling place. That is for 8 months in the year. In the rainy season, the Buddha actually stipulated that one should have a more sheltered location. But for 8 months, that would be the default. A nice kuti, a cabin, and so on, a cave, all allowable. But if it's not available, the monk should be content just with a tree. But it's not only for contentment, but also for the energy. In particular, evergreen trees, I think they have even stronger energy. So give that a try. I once did that. You feel like you're connecting with something. As there's a tremendous energy flowing out from the ground up, down. And of course, if you're sitting cross-legged and with the back against the tree, which would be the typical posture, and with these subtropical and tropical trees, you know, they often have these roots and kind of spreading out. And so you have got these parts of the roots and on your side. So you're almost like on three sides surrounded by the tree and only open in the front. A very strong energy you connect with. Yeah, there's a few reflections. Wanted to share that experience I very much enjoyed, and to just encourage you to get out there, connect with the energy of trees, with the energy of rocks, get your feet dirty in the grass, on dirt, a different kind of earth. Now, what is it like walking on sand or walking on dusty, dry soil? What is it like walking on the more like clay soil? What is it like walking on concrete? Not so nice on concrete. Someone suggests we may connect better with the elements when they are natural. There's also light in our buildings and so on, but I totally agree, it's not the same like having the sun. Some time ago I read about short-sightedness increasing in children and adolescents, and probably connected with the screens. But one problem with the screens is not only that you may strain the eye when looking on them, but that you are lacking looking outside when there's natural sunshine. Obviously, you don't look directly into the sun or anything like that, but after all, our eyes are designed to be out in nature and to actually get sunlight, and not directly looking into it. But apparently it's important for the health of the eye, you know, that you are exposed, you know, to natural sunshine. I mean, this becomes a big thing once you're talking about these electric lights. I think these, for my own subjective feeling, the LEDs, good LEDs, are better than the neon ones. Before it went LED, there was this period between the incandescent ones, which I think are fairly decent, and then was a period when they had this fluorescent. And I think I even know that that is a very unnatural light. It looks white, but if you analyze the spectrum of a fluorescent one, it's actually an extremely narrow spectrum, but skillfully chosen, that you perceive it as kind of white light, but it's totally, totally different in the spectrum and the range of frequency from a natural sunlight. But of course, even an LED cannot provide that, because the sun also gives you an ultraviolet and infrared and so on. And infrared you can feel, ultraviolet you're has effects on you. So totally agree, no lamp or artificial light would be in any way comparable to the sun. An interesting one is the moon. I remember once visiting another monk in Bundelukuti in Sri Lanka. And I was there in the full moon night. And there's also a beach you can reach. And it's also empty. So we went for a really long walk at nighttime along the beach in the full moon night, in this tropical full moon. And I started feeling really a little bit peculiar. And it felt like, obviously you don't get sunburned, like wouldn't call it moonburned, but you can get a heat stroke from the sun, a moon stroke. It felt really like something is happening, because obviously it was still hot, even at night, and we were just alone on the beach, you know, just two monks, and so we just walked in our underrobe, and then all the skin, anything exposed there. And I'm not sure, I would suggest that it does have some effect, which I cannot explain. But if you walk with quite a bit of bare skin for hours in the tropical full moonlight, unimpeded on the beach, it has some effect, I'm sure. As a kid. Yeah, yeah.
And we used to go up to the rooftop and we just lie down there and it's really nice.
And moonbathe.
Yeah, moon.
Moonbathe, yeah.
And also stars.
Stars, night sky, yes. Yes, totally agree. It was also common in ancient India. You read that in the suttas. The king is sitting on the roof of the palace. This is where they often would be, because this is where it most quickly cools out at night time, on a hot day, and then on top of the building. So hopefully we can give encouragement to everyone to be more open to experiment a bit, and in particular connecting with nature. You're so connected with screens and the World Wide Web. We may not have the chips quite yet in our brains, but even without the brain chip, people are already kind of tied to the devices, and via the device into the internet, the mind is already in a kind of stuck and entangled there and so on. I don't think that you can realize the awakening in the internet, so you have to first pull the mind out of that into conventional reality, or in terms of nature, in the screen, in the virtual world, it's like a dream within a dream. I think it's a poem from Poe, Edgar Allan Poe, Dream Within a Dream. And then you're two steps from awakening. Because even what we normally call a real reality, that is still only a dream from the perspective of the truly awakened one. But if within this dream we're additionally in some virtual reality, then you're two steps away. So first we have to get into this reality, and from there then to let go into the real reality. Ta-ta-ta. To suchness, to thusness. What is really real, and what is really real, now only one thing, Nibbana. Sapangvittatangidang, Natva, Lokena, all the rest of the world is vittata, is not real, only the experience of awakening.